This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the December 1985 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Magic Cookies by Thomas Wilde. "Hey, wait up, you guys," Brandon whispered fiercely. 20 yards ahead of him, Carl and Buzz rounded a corner, their sneakers smacking and squeaking on the concrete. He was getting ditched again. "It's not fair," he thought. Brandon rounded the corner and collapsed against the brick wall, wheezing to catch his breath. In the distance, he heard the ringing of a chain-link fence. He shivered. It was spring, and though the midnight air was not cold, as the sweat broke from his skin and soaked his shirt and steamed away into the dark, he felt chilled. First Street was empty. He trotted on towards the rattling fence at the end of the alley. There he found Carl and Buzz standing on the other side, waiting for him. "Come on, Bran," said Buzz, grinning. "You wanted to come." Brandon did a comic take at the height of the fence. "I'll never make it over that." Buzz looked at Carl. "Really?" "Why not?" said Carl. Brandon played the buffoon, grabbing his belly in both hands. "'Cause I'm too fat," Buzz said. "Really?" Carl said. "Why didn't I notice that before?" For a moment, all three of them stared at one another through the fence. Then the scene was over and Brandon turned away. His clown's face collapsed, his stomach sour. He heard them running off, snuffling with that hysterical laughter that happens when it's imperative not to make a sound. Brandon limped to the mouth of the alley. His new sneakers, the ones he'd pestered his mother a month for, hurt his feet. Now at least he wouldn't have to pretend they didn't. The main drag was quiet. From where he stood near the end of the business district, he could see all three stoplights blinking red in a halo of faint mist. He felt in his windbreaker pocket for the last of the Snickers. He'd bought three of them from the vending machine at the closed gas station a block from his house and had already given two of them to his buddies at the beginning of their short romp. He'd stood by while they ate theirs, pretending not to be hungry at the moment, though he was always hungry, because he didn't like to be seen eating. He just knew his unholy belly craving for food showed in his face when he ate. Now he was alone, as he had cynically predicted when he sneaked out of the house, and there was no reason not to eat the damn thing. For a moment he thought some miracle might have occurred and the candy bar would taste rotten, that he had somehow learned his lesson, grown up, snapped out of it, come to gain control over the central craziness of his life. But, of course, the Snickers tasted great, and it was all gone before he could hardly get used to its dark, sweet taste. He carefully licked the wrapper, rolled it up, and put it in his pocket. "No clues, please." "Okay, here I am, 10 past midnight, and everybody with any sense is in bed. What's to do?" "Oh, yeah, the bakery riddle." Every morning, Zwang's bakery simply reeked of fresh pastry and bread, and they never sold day-old stuff. Was that because they never had any left over? Or was it possible? Oh my God, they just dumped it? The idea was both infuriating and tantalizing. His mouth began to water. Getting ditched always made him hungry. Bandry was so wound up he forgot to limp. Zwang's bakery was only 3 blocks from home, squeezed in between a Kentucky Fried Chicken and a pizza joint. A Sears catalog store completed the little shopping center. The alley was dark, and he wished he had a flashlight. He stepped silently to the cold metal lip of the trash container and looked over the side. It was hopelessly black inside. He sniffed the air, and it was sweet and dark and spicy. He hesitated. Was it worth going over the side? As he stood, undecided, shivering in his damp clothes, he glanced at the back door of the bakery. His heart almost stopped. The door was a dead black chunk of space. He could see, could feel, the cold steel door swung open against the inside wall. He stood in the doorway and strained to see, to hear. Once, in the bakery after school, he joked with old Mrs. Wang about how nice it would be to own a bakery. She said, "So you want to get up every morning 3:30 and commence the baking?" 3:30, she'd said. It was only a little past 12. She must have left it open by mistake. His mind filled with the image of a shop half full of day-old pastries. Forget the damn dumpster. He stood in the doorway sniffing. There was something. He stumbled forward across the threshold. His eyes adjusted slowly, and he suddenly got the feeling there were people standing just inches away, waiting for him to get used to the dark. Of course, they could see him standing in the doorway. He felt instantly vulnerable, like coming into a dark movie house out of the bright sunshine. The movie is playing, but the scene is lit for night, black as coiled licorice. You stumble down the aisle, peering hopelessly into theoretical rows, absolutely blind to the occupancy of the seats, and you know they can see you plainly, that they marvel at your stumbling, that they giggle at your apologetic groping amongst them. He dared not move. Something was looming in the hallway, fabricating itself out of the darkness in excruciating silence. He looked to one side, trying to use the more sensitive part of his eye. Something was there. The air was hot and spicy, alive with faraway murmurs. What is that? Then he knew. It was a mannequin, a dress shop dummy. He whispered, "Jesus H. Christ," and the mannequin whipped out in sudden fury and grabbed his wrist. He started to scream, but a warm, dry hand smacked across his mouth and pressed it shut. The mannequin swung him around, the door slammed shut, the lights came on. It was no mannequin. "Mrs. Wang," he gasped. "Wait a minute." It was Mrs. Wang, all right, but not the soft old lady he'd seen a million times after school, bagging up a pair of cream cuffs or a dozen sweet cookies for him. This Wang was hard and mean, and his sense of relief puffed away on the heat of his eyes. She's out of her mind. She pressed him against the wall, hands still at his wrist and mouth. How could she have hands that strong? 50 years of kneading dough. As this answering thought swarmed through his mind from without, a new film of sweat burst from his face. The old woman smiled, and he recoiled, banging his head against the concrete wall. She took her hand from his mouth and put it on his belly. "Fat boy," came the words in his mind. "You are very naughty tonight. What am I to do with you?" she asked. He hardly realized she had spoken. He looked beyond her head into the back room of the bakery. His eyes widened. One large white enameled table was half full of motionless brown babies, their delicate knees bent akimbo. Each had a tiny head raised to its mouth. "My babies," she said without speaking, "my beautiful babies." "You have big eyes," she murmured. Now he could smell the ovens. "What are you doing to those babies?" She giggled. "I eat them." He swayed on his feet. She playfully lifted a baby and tore off a soft brown arm. She pushed tiny fingers into her mouth. Brandon began to slide along the wall towards the door. She grabbed his shirt front and dragged him to the bench. "There," she said. "Smell the blood." She pushed the stump of the arm into his face. It smelled like bread. Of course. When he looked at the table again, it was obvious. The brown babies were grotesque loaves of bread. But who in this town wanted such bread? "It is a secret," she said, her old face pressed close. She looked momentarily worried, and he immediately wondered if he might get something out of this, if he were to tell. "I suppose," she said, her eyes closed, "you would like a reward for your silence." He nodded, trying to be as cool as the gangsters on TV, but he was too scared, and when the old woman suddenly opened her eyes, he drew his breath audibly. That made her smile. She looked him over slowly. "You're a boy who loves to eat, yes?" He nodded, stunned and confused. "How would you like some cookies?" she said, twisting her head to study his eyes. "Yes, yes, cookies are a boy's best friend." He felt her strong hands rubbing his left hand, pushing and prying his fingers, squeezing them painfully. "Cookies," she said, and her eyes rolled upward. "Lovely cookies. You like chocolate? Of course you do, and vanilla. Sweet and tasty, melt in your mouth, crumbs like soft butter, cream filled with fudge, dark and biting. Lieblich. Cookies, yes? A handful of cookies to take with you, to have with you always, yes. That would be nice. Cookies." He could taste them as she spoke. Chocolate, vanilla, a hint of banana melting crunchily in his mouth, crushed between his teeth, pressed against his tongue, his mouth filled with saliva. "You like that," she said. "Oh, yes," she could tell. When he opened his eyes, there were two cookies in his left hand, a black one between his thumb and forefinger, a yellow one nestled in his palm. "Try one," she said softly. "I guarantee." He bit hungrily into the chocolate cookie. It was exquisite, a dark explosion of sweetness in his mouth. He finished it at once, and as he did so, the yellow cookie seemed to jump up to take its place between his thumb and forefinger. He bit eagerly into it, and his head jerked with the pleasure of it. Before he could pop the last morsel into his mouth, he felt a tickling movement in the palm of his hand. Another chocolate cookie grew magically there, and as soon as he emptied his fingers of the vanilla banana cookie, the new one jumped, fully formed, to his grip. He hesitated, mouth still watering, and felt the tingling growth of a new yellow cookie in his palm. He looked at the old woman and grinned. "Like them?" she said. "Of course you do." He nodded belatedly and bit into the fresh chocolate cookie. In a few minutes, he realized that he would never tire of the cookies. Whichever one was clamped between his finger and thumb, that was the one he wanted the very most. Going back and forth was a delight. Old Lady Zweng guided him to his feet and pointed him out the back of the shop. She opened the door for him. "Remember," she said, "tell no one of the baby bread or of the cookies. These are special secrets just for you and me, yes?" He stumbled out into the dark alley, turned to give her his assurances. The door slammed in his face. He couldn't believe his good luck. He'd gone looking for a pile of day-old pastry and had come away with an endless supply of the finest cookies in the world. Out of sight! He stood for a moment in the alley, then was afraid the patrol car might pass by. He danced away home, gobbling cookies as he went. The house was dark and quiet. He sneaked into his room and got undressed. Then he went into the kitchen and got a 2-liter jug of Coke and a glass full of ice. For the next hour or so, back in his room with the door locked, he munched cookies and drank Coke and watched an old Jack Oakey flick on TV with the sound on real low. It was fun. He made it to bed about 3:30. At 8, his mother woke him, banging on his door. He lied, yelling that he was sick and couldn't go to school. She wanted to see that for himself, so he jumped out of bed, unlocked the door, and dived for the covers again, holding his left hand. His mother leaned close. "You look like hell." "That's what I said," he hastened to add, "but I'll probably be all right for tomorrow." Tomorrow was Friday. She frowned, and her limp hair fell across her face. He guessed she'd be wearing one of her wigs to work today. When she had gone, he chewed sleepily at the crumbling cookies in his hand, then dozed off for another 2 hours. When he got up, he turned on the TV and crawled back into bed to watch a game show. Then he watched cartoons, followed by back-to-back episodes of Adam 12. At 2, he got out of bed and onto the bathroom scale and discovered that Despite all the cookies he'd eaten, he hadn't gained any weight. His stomach gurgled happily. He stared at his face in the mirror. He looked like the Pillsbury Doughboy on drugs. He went to brush the hair out of his face and raked his forehead with cookie crumbs. Damn it. Cooking breakfast proved equally messy. He kept grabbing for things with the wrong hand. He left a trail of crumbs everywhere he went. It was more than an inconvenience. It was becoming the most important thing in his life. He began to wonder, finally, how the hell he was going to get through the next 60 years of his life. He thought, I'll have to keep my hand in a bag. This is not working out, he muttered. He sniffed at the cookies. Devil's food, right? But as he tentatively nibbled the chocolate cookie, he was at once appalled and perversely delighted to find that it was still the most delicious cookie he'd ever tasted. The hell with it. He wolfed down his sausage and eggs, then marched back to his bedroom with another jug of Coke. He spent an hour sitting before the television set, downing the excellent cookies. There would be plenty of time later to worry about the future. I can always have them surgically removed, he said suddenly. He laughed, but the sound seemed to die in the empty house. At 3:30, as he wandered about the house, he saw the first of the high school kids coming home. He watched them pass in the street out front, singly and in groups, talking happily or moping along. He heard shouts and taunts and saw Carl and Buzz stalk by. They ignored his house. He felt, as usual, left out. He was leaving the window when he saw her. Tawny Cartmell, a girl in one of his classes, was coming up his driveway. Oh, no. He ran for his bedroom and grabbed his robe, crazily jamming his fists through tangled arms. The doorbell rang. Oh, my God. He crashed through his bedroom door, struggling with the tie sash like some inept strangler. The handful of cookies kept getting in his way. Christ! He skidded into the hallway, almost ran headlong into the front door, grabbed the doorframe to hold himself up. The doorbell rang again. What the hell does she want? In the 3 years he'd seen her around school, he'd never said a single word to her. She was beautiful, and he was, well, he was Brandon, the fat boy. He took hold of the doorknob, then hastily jammed his left hand into his robe pocket. He opened the door. Brandon? She asked. She smiled. He blinked at her, grinning like a buffoon. She carried her books against her breasts, and he stared openly as she fumbled with them to retrieve a slip of paper. Mrs. Bates wanted me to give you next week's assignment. She looked up, handing him the text. Just in case. He was still blinking, but he managed to take hold of the paper and grip it hard to keep from dropping it. You know, she said, finals are coming up and everything. Thank you, he said, trying to think of something intelligent to say. But you're coming back before then, of course. Oh, yes, he said, trying to think of anything to say. She was about to go, her duty completed. He held out his hand. Want a cookie? She stared at him as if he were out of his mind, and it suddenly dawned on him that the cookies might not be real. That's the trick. They're imaginary cookies. But no. Looks tempting, she finally said. She peered at it doubtfully. He realized she must have seen him yank his hand out of the robe. Maybe she was inspecting the cookie for lint. But I'm on a diet, she said, and she smiled. But not very much. He thought, disgusting, aren't I? They're very good, he said. Try one. For one intense moment of lunatic hope, his mind wrapped around the notion that the cookies, obviously magical in origin, might also turn out to be an aphrodisiac. She studied the chocolate cookie. He held it close to her nose as if to entice her. He began to feel as though he were starring in a cartoon, but it was too late now. If he jerked the cookie back, it might look even weirder. He held it close to her and waited to hear her refusal. Then she could go home, and he could shut the door and collapse on the floor. But she said, Are they really good? Cookies of the gods, he said, I swear. She grinned and plucked the cookie from his fingers. He quickly pulled his hand away so she wouldn't see how the next cookie popped up in place. He smiled at her, too nervous to speak. She put the cookie to her lips and looked into his eyes until he broke eye contact, about a fifth of a second. He imagined himself, the serpent, handing Eve the deadly fruit. Okay, baby, this is going to open your eyes. And it did. The moment after she put the cookie into her mouth, she yanked it out, gagging. She spat crumbs at him, her face twisting. You creep, she yelled, throwing the cookie at his head. That's horrible. She almost dropped her books, but she got control, slapped at his hand when he tried to help, and ran off the porch and down the driveway. He was stunned. Halfway down the driveway, she turned quickly and yelled, God, Brandon, you are such a creep! And she was gone, trotting up the street. He had to pick up the cookie to close the door. He sniffed it, tasted it tentatively, then ate it. Waste not, want not. The cookie tasted fine to him. You are such a creep. He went back to his bedroom and dropped down in front of the TV. Creep, creep, creep. The word bounced around in his head. I hate her. No, I hate myself. In half an hour, he had gone through another couple of dozen cookies. Each one tasted as good as the last, but now there was a certain novelty to his activity. Creep, said the cookie as he crunched through it. Creep, creep, creep. At 8:30, his mother called from some noisy bar and said she'd be eating out that night. Brandon said fine and hung up. He was already in the middle of his dinner. Creep, creep, creep. When she got home at midnight, she went straight to her bedroom and slammed the door. He was lying awake in the dark. His stomach felt funny, but every time he touched one of the cookies to his lips, he couldn't help but jam it into his mouth. Creep, creep, creep. In half an hour, when the noises stopped coming through the wall from his mother's bedroom, Brandon got groggily to his feet. There was one way out of this. He'd have to go back to the bakery and beg old Lady Zwang to take the cookies away. He immediately suffered a pang of regret, and the wondrous taste of the cookies haunted his mouth. Idiot. He forced himself out of the house, walking shakily. What if the old woman ripped him to pieces? It would be nice to have some backup, but he had no friends, none at all. Carl's house was dark. Brandon stared at it, thinking about the last time he'd come to play. It must have been 5 years at least. It was about then that he had seemed to drop out of neighborhood activities. He thought, this is stupid. Nobody is going to help me. He remembered which window was Carl's, though, and he stood beneath it looking up. He couldn't find any pebbles, so he tossed a cookie at the glass. A moment later, a face appeared, and the window opened wider. What do you want? Said Carl. You want to hang out? Said Brandon. I got an idea. Carl was astonished. What? I want to check out Zwang's bakery. They might... Forget it, said Carl. They're out of business. The old lady killed herself last night. He cocked his head. Everybody was talking about it today. I wasn't at school, Brandon muttered, his voice an echoing cave of impossibilities. Dead? Closed? Out of business? Gone forever? Take off, creep, Carl said abruptly. The window slid down. The curtains swung together. Brandon stepped back into the hedge. He closed his fist on the cookies and threw a handful of cookies into the air. The alley behind the bakery was deserted. He'd already walked briskly past the big front windows on the street side. There had been a small sign announcing the end of the business, and all the racks and counters were bare. The alley echoed to the crackle of his street shoes on the sandy asphalt. The steel door was shut tight. She's gone, he thought. She's really gone. He peeked over the lip of the dumpster, then snapped on the little flashlight he'd brought just in case. The dumpster was half full of junk. Empty bags of flour and sugar, ripped boxes of dark chocolate and so forth. Beneath the paper and the cloth lurked lumps of tan and yellow stuff. He couldn't reach the surface of the trash, and the alley disclosed not a single stick with which to probe the contents of the dumpster. He hesitated a moment then, because the dumpster was the only link left to the old woman. He climbed, grunting, over the side and dropped into the container. The trash made a soft sighing sound as he sank into it. As he began to dig through the stuff, the beam of his tiny flashlight dimmed and flickered and threatened to go out altogether. "Come on, come on," he whispered desperately. "Just give me 5 minutes." There was a pile of pastry beneath the paper, sugary lumps of dough that sparkled in his dim light. Some of it was wet, unbaked, rotting. His stomach turned at the sight, but he dug deeper. He had to hold the failing light in his right hand, which left only his cookie-filled fist to do the digging. Progress was slow. He was clubbing the ant-infested rolls aside with his arm when he saw the naked foot. He recoiled, banging his head against the side of the dumpster. He was stunned and nearly fell dizzily into the trash. He swayed a moment, breathing hard, the sweet stench of the container. When he looked again, he had to look again. The foot became a crescent roll. He held his soggy cookies tightly in his clenched fist. What am I looking for? Old lady's wang? His legs, buried in trash to his knees, jerked away from the image of her hand reaching out. The flashlight went dead. He smacked it insanely against his thigh, and the beam flashed orange and dim. He screamed. His leg was crawling with large black ants. The light went out and stayed out. He hopped madly in the trash, flinging the dead flashlight and using his right hand to slap at his legs. He lost his footing and fell, glancing off the slippery steel walls, his burden left hand grabbing ineffectively. He landed face down in the trash and squirmed to roll himself over. He could feel the contents of the dumpster roll under his body, poking, probing, grabbing at him. A large, flabby bag of flour wrapped itself around his legs. Soggy sweet rolls, shaped like mangled babies, seemed to march across his face. He gagged and screamed. "My hands are strong," said a voice in his mind. He thrashed about, banging the sides of the container. For a second, it seemed he was worming his way deeper and deeper into the can, and he inspected any instant to come face to face with the old lady. He could almost feel her lips pressed to his, soft, dusty, sickly sweet, her tongue swollen, pale as a maggot. He clenched his teeth and rolled forcefully face down in the garbage. It was the only way he could get the leverage. He came quickly up to his knees, flinging his arms all about in a rage. Then he stood, jumping back till the wall of the dumpster pressed his back. He whirled, grabbed the edge and pulled with all his strength, kicking his legs as he went. Whatever had bound his legs broke loose at last, and he pitched over the edge into the alley, landing hard on his back on the dirty asphalt. The alley suddenly brightened. A car was coming around the corner at the far end, a red light gleaming in its roof, the patrol. He suddenly thought, who in this town wants bread shaped like babies? Brandon jumped to his feet and ran as hard as he could all the way home. In his dark room, he lay in bed, gnawing cookies unhappily. Their taste was fading, turning rank, and more than once he had to reach for the table lamp, worried there were large black ants crawling all over them. So he ate slowly in the dark, as if he meant to come at last to the end of them, to exhaust the capabilities of magic. He half hoped that if the old woman was really gone, the spell would fade. Early in the morning, he turned on the lamp and held his hand under the beam. Very deliberately, he voided his fist in one rapid motion. For that brief instant, his hand was empty, though a raw red patch blemished his palm. Quickly, though, the patch began to bulge and take on texture. In a few seconds, the cookie was formed, and it darted to the place between his thumb and forefinger. The next cookie was already taking shape. 5 or 6 times he dumped the cookies and watched as they formed themselves again without hesitation. He turned off the light and lay back on the bed. As if to mock him, his next experimental taste of cookie was delicious, every bit as good as his first taste. He groaned as he chewed, his mouth compulsively watering. He thought, "This is not working out." He pulled the half-eaten cookie from his mouth and swallowed painfully. His throat was raw. What am I going to do to myself? The last thing in this world he needed was an endless supply of cookies. 16 years old, and he was already 80 pounds overweight. At this rate, he'd never see 40. I don't want to die. His left fist closed tight, and he felt the cookies shatter. Damn, old lady Zwang. What he really needed was a magic weight reduction pill, something that would slim him down at once. He tried to imagine what he would be like, wearing regular-sized clothes, striding down the sidewalk, winking at the girls with their cute, astonished faces. "Hey, baby, yeah, it's me. What do you think?" "Sure, pal," he whispered. "Dream on." He wanted to scream, and the rage grew. "Get away from me!" He threw the half-eaten cookie away. Then he threw the 2 new ones in his left hand against the wall. There was an explosion of crumbs in the dark. That felt good. Action. That's right. Had to do something. He had to act to get himself free. He had the power. He spent a long time in the dark throwing the cookies into a corner of his room as fast as they formed in his hand. He liked to hear them hit the wall, enjoyed the soft fluttering thud as they disintegrated. Sometimes he threw them hard. Other times he tossed them limply, mechanically, with vague regret. They were such good cookies. It was exhausting, dizzying work, but he kept at it. There had to be an end to this. There had to be. The whole rest of his life was at stake. At dawn, he zonked out, his head clogged with dreams of toil and fright. He awoke and savagely threw the crumbling cookies in his fist at the dim pile in his mourner. The sudden motion made him dizzy, and he had to close his eyes. What's happening to me? He dreamed he was lying in the bottom of the dumpster. Old Lady Zwang had climbed onto his body and was banging his head with her hard fists. He could hear the blows crashing on his fragile skull. He woke up to a pounding on his door. "Hey, sport!" his mother yelled in. "You said you'd be going in today." "All right," he said, and the effort nearly made him faint. He lolled in his bed, fists clenching weakly. Instantly, he opened his eyes and looked at his left hand. It was empty. He stared blearily at it, the morning light. His hand was dark, ruddy, blistered, but empty. He kept staring, 5, 10, 15 seconds. No new cookie grew there. He fell back in bed, exhausted, too tired even to rejoice. They may come back. His mother was back at the door, banging. "Come on!" He groaned. Now he really was sick. "Okay," he wanted to scream, but the word lay dead in his thick throat. His heart missed a beat, then doubled up on the next. He was dizzy again, and he knew he'd never be able to stand up. He put his right hand on his bony chest and felt the way his heart jumped and shuddered. It reminded him of his mother's car when it kept running raggedly after the ignition was off. "I'm dead, but my heart doesn't know it yet." His hand slid down over his belly. Something was terribly wrong. His once plump belly was slack and fallen, his skin loose and floppy. He tried to raise his head, caught a glimpse of his sunken, emaciated body, then fell back nauseated. His heart kept skipping beats. "I've been emptied out." His mother was banging on the door. "Brandon!" He squandered the last of his strength, rolling towards the edge of his bed. He looked into the corner where he'd thrown the magic cookies, but they were no longer there. In their place was a large, wet pile of gelatinous fat. There had to be 50 pounds of the yellow, runny stuff, maybe 100. his head dropped, his strength gone. The room was silent, the door pounding over. Maybe she's going to get a neighbor to kick it in. The cookies, those magical cookies, had to come from someplace. Now he knew where. Manufactured from my own fat. It made perfect sense. His heart shuddered again, and he wondered if his mother would come back in time. Won't she be surprised? She always thought I'd die fat. Not me. Not me. The ceiling blurred, and he closed his eyes. His banging heart shook the bed. It was as if all his strength had been concentrated there. My heart wants to escape so long. His mind drifted. Later, he saw faces peering down. And after that, a siren whined, coming closer. You better hurry. His mind jumped ahead. There he was, imperially slim, walking fast along First Street. A smile played at his lips. What do you think? In the ambulance, he reached out dreamily and rubbed his left hand on the plastic wall. Don't do that, said a voice. It itches, he whispered. Then his hand fell back upon the sheet, palm up, empty. We continue with a story from the August 1985 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is Man of Parts by James Gunn. This story begins and ends in a hospital. It is about death and suffering and self-mutilation in a number of unpleasant ways. Christ, you say, who wants to read a story about hospitals and death and suffering and self-mutilation? Well, it is about life and miracles and self-sacrifice too, and maybe about the salvation of the world. And if you read it in the right spirit, it will make you feel good about the human race. It begins, in a way, in a 1759 book by Adam Smith, The Theory of Moral Sentiments. Smith wondered how a man with normal human feelings might respond to the news that a fearful earthquake had swallowed up millions of Chinese. Smith believed that the man would go on with his business or his pleasure as if nothing had happened. But if he were told that he would lose his little finger the next day, he wouldn't be able to work or sleep for worrying about it. Benny Giroux knew nothing about Adam Smith. In fact, all he knew at the moment about himself was that he was 35 years old and his mother was sick. That upset him. His mother was almost never sick, and it was her refusal to be sick that led to Benny's surprising discovery. After months of watching his mother get thinner and paler, Benny finally persuaded her to enter the hospital for tests. They revealed that she had cancer of the liver. There was no doubt about it. Benny was as certain as if the doctor had held out the traitorous organ to him in the operating room and said, "See? Cancer. There's no hope." Not that he had faith in doctors, but in cause and effect. Benny was allowed to look at the specimen under the technician's microscope. It was an unusual courtesy to allow a man with no more stature or powers of persuasion than Benny, but he was a stubborn man, and he loved his mother better than life himself. Many people say that, but Benny meant it. He loved his mother better than life itself. As he sat by her hospital bed while she was sleeping away the post-operative trauma, he looked at her pale cheeks and her gray hair spread upon the white pillow and whispered, "Please, God, take me, not her." But her breathing continued raggedly in the quiet room. It would stop for long periods when he thought he had lost her, and then it would suddenly start up again. Maybe he was being too passive, he thought. Maybe leaving the decision to someone else. "Okay," he said to the empty air, and stood up and walked quietly down the redolent corridor. He rode in the elevator to the first floor, walked out to the parking lot, opened the door to his mother's Chevrolet, stuck his finger in the door jamb, and slammed the door on it. The doctor who trimmed and sewed the stump said, "You must have been thinking about your mother." "That's true," Benny said. The moment after he had slammed the door had been filled with pain worse than anything he had imagined. Surely it hurt worse than death. At the same time, his whole being had been swept by a thrill of satisfaction. When he went back to look at his mother, her breathing was regular and her eyes were open. She recognized his face and smiled. "Benny, I feel better." He felt a surge of happiness such as he had not experienced in any of his previous 35 years. His sacrifice had been accepted. "I'm going to be all right," his mother said, and she was. Benny would not have thought any more about the matter, other than a periodic thankfulness for his mother's recovery. But not his mother brought up the manner of the astronauts in their faulty capsule. The capsule was Apollo 13. The date was April 11th, 1970, and the three juniors, Lowell, Hazy, and Swigert, were hurtling towards the moon in a capsule with a defective power supply. "There they are," his mother said. "They can't do nothing. It's a real pity nobody down here can help them." Benny nodded and said nothing, but he thought about it. What was a finger to him compared to life for the astronauts and the honor of his country? This time, he lopped off the little finger of his right hand in a paper cutter. It was neater and less painful. His mother turned on the car radio as she was taking him to the emergency room at the hospital. They both heard the announcement that the moon landing had been canceled, but that the crew was safe and the capsule was returning to Earth. The stinging in Benny's right hand was replaced by a feeling of power. Perhaps the rest of the world was helpless, but he was not. He thought about the other three astronauts who had been killed in a flash fire while their capsule had been sitting on the ground. There had been no warning of that, or he might have saved them too. The next opportunity came a few months later. A child was dying of leukemia. Benny didn't know the little girl personally, but she lived in his town, and the newspaper ran an article about her disease and her courage. Benny thought she was remarkably pretty. He cut off his left little toe with a chisel while he was working on a model boat in the basement. The little girl made a recovery that had her doctors shaking their heads in disbelief, and people began commenting about Benny's clumsiness. Even his mother, who seldom noticed Benny's mistakes or odd ways, thought something was strange about it. "Can't understand why you was working down there in your bare feet," she said, shaking her head. "Don't see either how you could get your foot up there." Benny shrugged. He didn't talk much, and he particularly didn't want to talk about this. Benny was a dishwasher. He had been a poor student, though he tried hard. His teachers said he had a reading problem, but he read murder mysteries all right. He liked the kind that didn't have violence or blood in them. He thought it was because his mind was logical, and he liked to figure them out. His father had died before Benny could remember him. His father had been an alcoholic who built his wife when he was drunk and would have beaten his infant son if his wife had not always interposed her body between them. One evening, his father had fallen down drunk on a cold, wet night, caught pneumonia, and died within 3 days. Occasionally, Benny felt a moment of regret when he thought that he could have saved him if it had happened when Benny became aware of his power. His mother, Ellen, was a strong woman. She had raised Benny all by herself without help from anyone. When she was young and not bad-looking, she had worked as a waitress. Later, she tended a machine that made envelopes in a greeting card factory. When the others stopped at a bar after work for a few beers or went bowling, Ellen went home to Benny. Her devotion and his father's death may have made Benny excessively dependent upon her and made other women seem vain and self-centered by comparison. He had never married. He had never even had a date with a woman. Benny was a master dishwasher. He had a precise blend of speed and thoroughness. He had got his first job in a diner when he was still in high school. When he had dropped out of school at the age of 18 without a diploma, continuing to wash dishes was the easiest thing to do. Since he lived at home, the pay was okay. He contributed most of it to household expenses. Most important, he liked washing dishes. He could stand with his hands in hot, soapy water and let his mind wander. His hands worked better when he didn't think about them. He graduated from the diner to a restaurant, and then to the best restaurant in town. The money wasn't much better, but in Benny's field it was success. Benny wasn't religious. He didn't go to church. He didn't think what the Sunday school teachers tried to tell him was logical, but he had faith. His mind wandered around to that while he was washing dishes. There had to be a reason for things, he thought. That's why there had to be a God. But there were reasons for other things as well. Good and bad luck, for instance. He had considered all the standard superstitions about bad luck and found them inadequate. Black cats, ladders, Friday the 13th, broken mirrors, stepping on cracks, knocking on wood, all the possible ways one could incur or avoid bad luck didn't work. He had tried them all. There was a reason somewhere, but he hadn't found it. The same with good luck. Some people were lucky, some were not. This he had observed over his 35 or so years, but he didn't know the reason. It wasn't God, he felt pretty sure. God wasn't arbitrary, giving good luck to people who didn't deserve it and bad luck to those who deserved it even less. And he didn't buy the bit about working in mysterious ways. There was no reason God should want to be mysterious. In fact, Benny could think of lots of reasons God wouldn't want to be. It was something else, a connection Benny hadn't discovered, something people did or didn't do that made them winners or losers. That is why Benny didn't find strange his ability to buy life for someone else at the price of a part of himself. He had simply stumbled onto the right cause and effect. Sometimes he wondered whether other people could do it too. He thought of asking them, but one by one he considered all the people he might ask, and one by one he discarded them. Even his mother might think he was talking crazy, and he knew there was a cause and effect relationship between talking crazy and ending up in a mental institution, and people had mentioned that before. What he was doing and thinking now, he felt certain, fell into an area that most people thought was crazy. Once, he hinted at it to his mother. "Mama, do you think people can heal other people?" he asked. "Doctors do it all the time," she said. "I mean healers, like faith healers." "I don't know," she said. "I ain't never seen it." "What if you saw it? Then maybe I'd believe it." But Denny decided in the end not to test his mother's tolerance. In any case, he liked having a secret, and he believed his situation was special. No one else did what he could do because no one else could do it. Otherwise, there would be a lot more miracle cures and rescues. Of course, it was possible that other people could do it, but didn't know about it, or they knew about it and didn't want to do it. But that seemed so unlikely that Benny discarded the idea immediately. Perhaps because he was so unimportant in other ways, he had been made important in this way. There was a reason for everything. He couldn't wash dishes for a while after he lost his little fingers, but his boss was understanding, and Benny and his mother had some money saved. That, plus his mother's Social Security and small pension, paid the bills until his stumps could heal. 4 fingers on each hand was not an intolerable handicap, and the bit of pain he endured was more than compensated by a feeling of accomplishment, of doing something for the world that nobody else could do, not even the wealthiest philanthropist. And yes, he had to admit it, a feeling of power. After the 3rd amputation, life became more difficult. The staff at the emergency room had begun to make remarks, and even his mother accused him of being clumsy when he dropped the old refrigerator onto the little toe of his right foot as they were making room for the new one. That was after news had come of a man and his wife lost in the Rocky Mountains for 2 weeks. She was discovered in good health in a cabin, but the husband had died of a heart attack before the news about them was released. Other occasions arose, and Benny had to think of increasingly ingenious methods of self-sacrifice in order to avoid the worst aspects of suspicion. Several cases of too little or too much rain came in a row over the next few years. The Mississippi threatened to flood almost the entire Delta area, but the rain stopped and the river crested lower than expected. An entire population of natives was starving in a drought-stricken area of Africa that Benny had never heard of. It didn't matter to Benny. The rain began to fall. The monsoons failed 2 years in a row in the subcontinent, wherever that was, but the second year they came unexpectedly late, bringing welcome floods to withering crops. On the other hand, a hurricane bore down on Florida before swerving suddenly and harmlessly out to sea. The local medical community had begun to talk about Benny not simply as accident-prone, but as a classic case because of the way his fingers and toes dropped off in so regular a fashion. Benny would have varied the order, but each time he had to consider the question of how much the next sacrifice would incapacitate him for simple survival. And then his mother was killed in an automobile accident. Death was instantaneous. Benny had no fingers or toes left, but he cut off his left hand with a saw. It didn't help. Ellen was dead, and Benny couldn't bring her back. As he bandaged Benny's stump, however, the doctor told him that his mother's liver had been fine right up until the end. "But Benny," the doctor said gently, "you're going to have to go into the hospital." "I don't want to," Benny said. "But Benny, you can hardly walk and you can't hold anything." "I can get by," Benny said stubbornly. The doctor looked at him suspiciously. "If you lose anything else, you'll have no choice." "I'll have no choice." Getting the United States out of Vietnam took Benny's left arm and put him in the hospital, the psychiatric wing he had always dreaded. But they allowed him a television set, and on it one day he saw the assassination attempt on President Reagan. He pulled himself into a wheelchair, and when everybody else was watching the television set in the lounge, he took the freight elevator to the basement where a repair project was underway and a table saw had been left unattended. Now Benny was virtually without mobility, and the entire staff was instructed to watch him closely. Though he seemed reasonable enough to talk with, he was, everyone said, definitely and completely round the bend. When the news came of the attempt on the Pope's life, Benny had to pull himself out of bed and fall to the floor, then drag himself down the hall to the elevator by one arm to offer his remaining hand to the elevator's descending floor. The psychiatrist in charge of Benny's case sometimes forgot his professional cool when he couldn't get any answers out of the lump of flesh that was left of Benny. "Can't you give me some idea why you've undergone this crazy program of self-mutilation?" Dr. Frederick asked. He wasn't supposed to use words like crazy, but he was past discretion. Benny shook his head. "Was it your mother?" Dr. Frederick asked. "Your father's brutality?" Benny's eyes flickered, but he didn't speak. "There had to be a terrible amount of self-hatred to make you cut yourself up this way," Dr. Frederick said. Benny looked scornful. "With the world going to hell the way it is," the psychiatrist said despairingly, "surely it doesn't need any help from you." Benny's eyes moved from the psychiatrist's face to the television set above the doctor's head, where tanks were rumbling in parades and missiles were being raised into firing position. "It's going to happen, isn't it?" Benny asked. It was going to happen, finally. The Armageddon everyone had feared for almost half a century, which mutually assured destruction, had finally stopped deterring. Benny knew it as certainly as he has known about his mother's cancer. "What's going to happen? What?" the psychiatrist asked impatiently. "That," Benny nodded at the television screen. "Television? The war, the bombs, the end." "Maybe." "I can stop it," Benny said. "You?" Benny nodded and began to tell the psychiatrist calmly the story of how he had learned about his power and what he had done with it. When he finished, the doctor looked at him for some time in silence. Finally, he said, "You believe this?" "It's true," Benny said simply. Why haven't you told me this before? I haven't told anybody. Why not? I figured they'd put me in a mental institution. You are in a mental institution. I know. Now it doesn't matter. The talking head, stuck on the appendageless torso, would have unnerved the keeper of an 18th century snake pit. And now you think you can stop World War III by means of a similar bodily sacrifice? Dr. Frederick asked. The last one, Benny said steadily. It's going to take a big one this time, but I need help. What kind of help? I can't get out of bed. You got to hold the knife. You must be out of your mind, Dr. Frederick said. He had done it again. But doctor, Benny began. Of course I can't do that, the psychiatrist said. But I can help in another way. Yes, Benny prompted. I can have the nurse give you a tranquilizer. Not that. Don't you understand? We're all going to die. Better just me than everybody. Nurse, the doctor called. Doctor, nurse. Benny struggled on the bed, but it was no use. He could not evade the pacifying needle. His past sacrifices had left him helpless. Next morning, however, they found his limbless trunk half off the bed. His head was discovered behind the bed, where it had been removed with surgical precision by the adjustable frame. The head was smiling. Adam Smith was wrong. Benny Giroux was right. Oh, there was no connection between Benny's sacrifice and the events that followed, you understand. But Benny thought there was, and was willing to sacrifice himself for others. The night he made his final sacrifice, the missiles did not arrive. Now, it's up to us. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.